Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioral change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by an incredibly interesting and dynamic individual, Alex Kecho, who's the head of cultural intelligence at Canvas 8, the award-winning consultancy that builds better ways to understand the world. She's also an associate lecturer in foresight and speculative futures at Central St Martin's. And back in the day, she was the Royal College of Art, where she did an MA in critical thinking. And before that, at the superb Emily Carr University in Vancouver, where she did a BA in fine arts. Basically, I'm intensely jealous of all of the above. So fantastic stuff. Alex, hi, and how are you?
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me. I'm doing great.
Alex, so I know we've got a ton of things to talk about today. I watched one of your recent really, really interesting online presentations, which we'll go through no doubt in a while, and then talk about other things that you're up to and things that are sort of coming online fairly soon. But I think, as with all these things, I think it's really, really interesting just to start off just by clarifying, the usual thing, how you got to where you are now. And usual question. Was it a very sort of a straight path or a very sort of a windy one?
As you probably can guess from your intro, it was a very winding path. My background is in the arts, in fine arts specifically. My arts education was during a time where I would say that the art world was a kind of junkyard of research, and I say that with love. It was, art was a repository for all kinds of weird and divergent investigations into history, biology, evolution, subjectivity, philosophy that traditional academia, let's say, or the commercial world couldn't quite hold. So that's sort of where I came from. I found that I was especially good at finding patterns, echoes, kind of shadows through both culture and commercial activity. And that kind of impulse structures both my personal research and my commercial work, especially when we're looking at like significant social changes and what's sort of behind them. So that's all to say it was a very windy path. I did some time in the gallery world. I've done some time in academia, I've written a book, and have found my commercial home at Canvas 8, and am very grateful to have been there for, I'd say, up to 4.5 years now.
Okay. So you mentioned, first of all, just back in the day in terms of all things academia. Emily Carr in Vancouver, I was looking online earlier on, so it's the centenary, I think, in a couple of years' time. Amazing.
You're more up on the alumni news than me.
There we are. So tell me, so your book then, Small Gods, let's start with that.
Yeah, sure. So Small Gods began as a kind of, like I said, I noticed a bit of an echo happening between, I would say, sort of militarized sphere, the sort of consumer technology sphere, and then also something a bit strange and new age in terms of like drone music, meditation, transcendence. And I was curious about, what that word contained and how it sort of resonated across culture. So I ended up investigating that through the point of view of 10, I'd say 10, but it sort of expands beyond that. But 10 artists that I was really interested in spending time with and thinking about their work. But there were some layers of kind of historical elements, some kind of music elements, some current events and all of that, sort of all wrapped in there. And the point of it all is really to think about, as soon as we have a technological innovation that is a little paradigm shifting, a little worrisome, a little sort of wrapped up in our projections into it. How do we actually metabolize that and understand that culturally and collectively? So the book sort of looks at that using visual art as the kind of mode of understanding, so to speak.
I see. Fascinating. And then in terms of the speculative futures course that you lecture on at Central St. Martin's, perhaps just unpack that a bit in terms of the sort of things you've been talking about recently and all the rest of it.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful course. My area is sort of built into the innovation MA at St. Martin's. So I have some really inspiring colleagues. It's a bit of a, they like to kind of refer to it as a hybrid creative course. So trying to teach some commercial skills alongside things like design thinking, cultural theory, and things like that. So my role there is to really help the students think through things like alternative and speculative futures, to understand that innovation isn't just things like user research, for example, but there's a kind of long creative tradition behind that as well. And we take a lot of interest in exploring, you know, what are the ways that we can imagine alternative or speculative futures? How can we do it in line with a sort of preferred industry future? Or how can we do it sort of against and like provocatively a kind of status quo approach to that? So it's a really fertile ground, and it's really, I feel really lucky to be around so many bright and challenging minds.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, St. Martin's is such a fantastic powerhouse, isn't it? I mean, I've been in and out of there many times over the years. So just in terms of what you're getting up to now with the mighty Canvas 8, as mentioned, I saw that the latest report that you presented a few weeks ago, I thought it was absolutely fascinating when you gave the sort of spotlight on chaotic communities. So perhaps just talk a bit about that, and then we'll go through the other things later on. But I thought, just as you mentioned the day, you know, from trash TikTok trends to Be Real booms, from metaverse vibes to Roblox riches, youth culture is being defined by how quickly audiences can swarm around a new virtual space and subvert expected behaviors. Fantastic. So Alex, over to you to unpack that one.
For sure. So the chaotic communities exploration was really deeply fascinating. Of course, TikTok really dominates our conversation around social media these days, especially since, you know, friends of mine that work in AI say everyone is incredibly jealous of TikTok's sort of social classification systems because it's so finely cut. And that sort of contributes to the sense of almost a positive fragmentation, where many of these users feel incredibly seen to a degree of fineness that is not really achievable in other corners of the internet. So we're seeing this sort of bedding in, we're seeing subculture very much being back, the sort of subcultural rivalries, which we thought were stamped out in the 2010s, for example, when the sort of Instagram monoculture was on the rise. People were saying, you know, is this the death of subcultures? Is this sort a sort of aesthetic that people are simply adopting and discarding? Now we're seeing a much more considered approach to identity. But in doing so, a lot of how legible that is also collapsing. So that gives us our kind of sense of chaos that we're contending with these days.
And perhaps just to talk a bit about, I mean, I think a couple of things you mentioned in the report and the presentation, and when you just looked at issues around sort of Generation Alpha and Gen Z and then social shakeups, et cetera, perhaps just to just go through that in a bit more detail.
Yeah, so with both Gen Z and Gen Alpha, this is something that we've sort of been discussing with my colleagues as well. With Gen Z, there's this sort of, they're kind of grew up in the shadow of Gen Y's sort of very determined dedication to building almost permanent digital personal brands. So Gen Y were very much defined by, you know, you were told don't post risky photos on Facebook. Don't sort of document the way that you actually live your life, because that could live online forever. Gen Z or Gen Z have a more kind of interesting approach to that. There's a hint of playful nihilism in it for sure. But they're also contending with a kind of different algorithmic environment. And so the issues of identity, of trying to fit in, of trying to carve out who you are against difference and similarity is always going to be kind of eternal here. But the big change that we've seen is that kind of fear of permanence doesn't quite hold in the same way. There's a lot more irreverence. There's a lot more playfulness. And most of all, there's a lot more willingness to try on perhaps different expressions of one's identity, even if identity, you know, as we define it as something that you both categorize yourself as, but is a result of your background, relationships, your place in society. But the way that you express that with the sort of younger generations has become far more fluid, far more playful, and far more unstable. And I mean that in a kind of positive way.
Yeah. Yeah, I find it really fascinating the way you presented that and the detail you went into. And I mean, just to just carry on that exact point that you're making just now, you're talking about things around, you know, you, I find it really interesting the sort of the fluidity of identity when you're talking about, you know, you can sort of choose your character mindsets on the rise, as in even the most obvious things of sort of, you know, character-led dressing. Really interesting.
Yeah, totally. I personally love that point of view. I think that it brings a lot of fun and intrigue back to self-expression. I think that another kind of parallel thing we've been exploring is, you know, a couple of years ago, the pop mindset of minimalism really took hold. If you can think of the moment of like Marie Kondo, the writer Kyle Chayka writing the sort of definitive book on sort of Western millennial minimalism. And the sort of complete U-turn we've seen now, where people aren't really that interested in kind of polished, modest dressing outside of religious reasons, aren't that interested in streamlining or optimizing their lives. Instead, there is this kind of interest in, like you said, this kind of choose your character mindset where trying out different kind of facets of one's persona, sometimes in line with a subcultural expectation and sometimes not. But of course, the dark side to that is that these accelerated trend cycles and the legibility of them go hand in hand with a kind of fast fashion style of consumption, much more so than they do with kind of slower, minimalist mindsets.
Yeah. And then also as a sort of, if you say, sort of a juxtaposition to the whole the sort of issue that you mentioned just now from the point of view of, I think you're talking about, you know, taking a very positive stance to instability of identity or unstable identities being done in a sort of, you know, very deliberate manner. At the same time, you also spoke about, you know, the realization that there's a lot of pessimism around on a sort of macro level with Gen Z.
Yeah, and that pessimism is really interesting. It's something that we've been tracking across many different regions. I was just looking into the pervasive pessimism in Japan, for example, especially among young people. I think the Nippon Foundation ran a survey and found that only, I believe, 10% of young people in Japan thought that they would be better off as adults. There's a kind of desire to change things, but like very low expectations of being able to meaningfully contribute to that change, which is, of course, worrying. And Gen Z is a really interesting group of people to consider that. I have my opinions as to how useful generational labels ultimately are, but for the sake of sustainability, I think generations still quite hold. Because Gen Z came of age in a very particular, I'd say, acceleration of our awareness of the climate crisis. And that's a big piece of research we've also done here at Canvas Aid is how immediate and how real the climate crisis feels now and how people are responding to that, not only through sort of anxiety and stasis, but also a kind of desire for kind of dramatic action, which of course is easy to kind of scoff at if, I've made that presentation to some unnamed clients and there has sometimes been laughter in the room because, you know, the world was or is seen to be quite stable from a certain perspective. But the truth is, there has even been a fairly, you know, conservative surveys that still have found that over a quarter of Gen Z are ready to, quote unquote, rebuild society from the ground up. Like, there is a kind of radical streak amongst this age group that I think results from the feeling like, you know, things are only getting worse, and kind of the stasis is a contributing factor there.
Mm. And you mentioned, and that report is something that's been done on an ongoing basis, and or has it been published?
It's something we've been tracking in regards to sustainability in particular. Canisate has a macro behavior called hypersustainability, which has been, over time, been tracking sort of actions around sustainability, and then tracking also emerging behaviors in terms of regeneration, degrowth, and all the sort of new discourse around contending with climate change in a way that will help us survive in the long term.
Oh, interesting. Well, perhaps the wrong word for it, but I mean, I think because that links into, perhaps, and we'll come back to the point you just made in a while, but it also links directly to a really fascinating piece that I know that you wrote for Wired magazine, Tropical Futurism, all about reimagining a different relationship to the Earth. I thought it was a great sort of way into that, as you put it, you know, or as you sort of put in a provocative manner, should we say, you know, futurism has failed. It's time for an alternative. So, go on, Annex, tell us about that.
That was very, you know, you got to have your hook somehow.
Exactly.
But I mean, it's something I by no means coined this term. It, I believe, was coined by the designer, curator, and researcher Chris Fussner, who has had a very admirably decentralized approach to his area of interest and has brought in an incredible amount of people quite organically into thinking about tropical futurism and what that could mean. So a lot of the kind of collective negotiations around it have been around specifically things like to look at the world as a whole, right? And the term majority world, instead of using a term like the global south or even a kind of rehabilitated term, the third world, these both have positive connotations to me because I'm from there. But to say majority world really shifts the perspective into thinking, you know, when we talk about things like degrowth, often that is seen as a kind of decline in living standards. But as is now sort of popularly dissected, that's not a decline for most people. It's perhaps a reduction for the most overdeveloped parts of our world's population, but it really will still be thinking about the improvement in living standards for most of the world's population. So it's just like a nice kind of flip of perspective there. And tropical futurism really addresses that. So instead of a futurism like cyberpunk, for example, that depends on a kind of acceleration and a shininess and a kind of extreme industrialization, how can we actually think of futurism, the future and survival of ourselves and of the planet, in from a perspective that encompasses, I'd say, the sort of pillars of like indigenous knowledge, kind of ancient and enduring and persistent forms of relating to our environment and to both communities, human and non-human, and all these kind of like really sort of provocative points that are layered into there that are ultimately kind of, you know, in an academic sense, like anti-colonial or anti-imperial. So there's a lot packed in there for sure.
Absolutely. And then with regards to the editorial side of things, and actually going back slightly to the chaotic communities piece that you presented, I think another, just one of the other points that I'd really like you to sort of cover off is, which I found really interesting, talking about, I think, as you put it, you know, talking with regards to engaged communities and how anyone can be a creator is a really, really dynamic area. So perhaps just talk a bit about that, about, you say that the sort of the democratization of creation.
Yeah, that's something I'm super interested in so many areas. So forgive me if I ramble a little
bit. Please do.
But, you know, with our particular consumer innovations, you know, my book was about the drone. And that has actually, it goes a little bit into how the consumer drone had completely changed filmmaking, for example. We can see the iPhone is having done that as well. Access to things like Premiere Pro, like the Adobe Suite, and of course, any number of ways that you can kind of educate yourself about this stuff. There's so many people out there now who can also make a living through, you know, publishing YouTube tutorials on how to be a better photographer or filmmaker. On top of that all, another thing that I've been really kind of following the rise of is the game engine, Unreal Engine. So that's another layer, I would say, to the sort of rise of creator accessible technology. But the rise of Unreal Engine, we can see is comparable to, I'd say, like the handheld video camera or the iPhone in particular, as something that is now giving a huge amount of people access to creating worlds that previously were kind of in a budgetary sense, completely inaccessible to like a casual or like consumer level user. So the kind of democratization of the modes of digital creativity, I would say, are incredibly, has, you know, really shifted the paradigms in terms of what creators feel capable of. And I think that's what we were beginning to explore in the Chaotic Communities seminar, and also another thing we're exploring in our World Builders macro behavior.
Very interesting. And then the World Builders macro behavior report that you've just put out, or came out, I think, sort of a month or so ago. I thought that was, again, super interesting. So perhaps you just talk a bit about that. I know it's a bit of a barrage of questions, but that is about, so as you put it there, so, you know, people constructing meaningful collectives. And you just went through a whole range of them in the report, from whatever, looking at social insulation down to, and actually you mentioned Japan earlier on. I think one of the points you mentioned from an earlier report was the sort of Oyo life thing, about, again, Japanese takes on that, along with issues around next door communities. I thought it was fascinating. So yeah, perhaps unpack a bit of that.
Yeah, so this was sort of brought together with my colleague Elizabeth Lee, yep, who is one of the masterminds behind this macro behavior. For anyone new to this style of research, a macro behavior is really a hypothesis about significant social and cultural change. So it's really a building block for a lot of the research that we do. And the way that we classify macro behavior is that it always has to be completely cross-market, completely cross-industry. We have to kind of identify it being driven by, you know, your classic steep drivers of social, technological, economic, environmental, and political drivers, yeah, and that it will have a kind of lasting trajectory in culture. And we definitely, and we map that out in the process as well. Okay. But that's kind of an overview of what those are.
Yeah.
But world building in particular is something we've been tracking for some time. It's definitely emerging, but with things like Meta's investment in the metaverse, that kind of popularization of Unreal Engine that we just discussed, the rise of things like consumer-led augmented and extended realities, and any number of startups and challengers in that space has really changed how people see their not only participation, but authorship of virtual worlds. But we were interested in moving that also beyond the space of technology. And again, this now links back to my like enduring obsession with speculative and alternative futures. So we were wondering, you know, why are so many cultural artifacts like artworks, movies, et cetera, that use these technologies and use these capacities for consumer level world building to present quite drastic and provocative alternative futures? And how does that relate to a kind of growing sense of collectivity that really has taken hold with the intensification of, you know, academically, you could call it polycrisis. So cost of living crisis, climate change, pandemic, literal war, all that stuff compounded. You know, what is this collectivism that's also arising not only out of entertainment, not only out of imagination, but also out of necessity? So sounds a bit complex, but we pulled that all into our world builders behavior and added our point of view on that, because we see these things as intensely connected at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah. I think also just as a slight aside to that, it's been fascinating just in terms of you mentioning all things sort of futuristic or not, but the series of the moment, the capture, as I say, as BBC says, it might feel like science fiction, but real-time deep fake tech is here. The question is, are they actually happening? But I mean, just in terms of the, again, get back to the sort of some of the macro issues that you list throughout that very detailed World Builders report, but just to again, to focus on a couple of them and to unpack what you're actually alluding to there. So just as a completely random list that I've noted down. So squad goals being at the forefront of Web3, just to clarify what that's all about.
Yeah, that is... I'll have to check my references here, but I believe it's from a research collective called Do Not Research.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of coined by thinkers within there. They're a collective, so I can't remember the exact names, but all credit goes to them for that particular phrase. But it is essentially a concept that explores it's a kind of shift from thinking about communities and thinking about collectives. A squad is something very particular, I would say, that is a bit, again, I think I have to check my thinking with this a bit, but is a bit more action-oriented, a bit more concentrated on things like how can you not only win more resources for the squad, but also equitably distribute those resources amongst all participants. You know, it's one of the kind of founding, without getting too deep into it, but it's one of the kind of founding principles of a lot of more esoteric Web3 stuff is this idea of a kind of roving squad that has the capabilities to kind of look out for each other, but also is a little more pragmatic than I would say a utopian collective, let's say.
And can I say on that issue there, as I, if I read it correctly, also on a sort of perhaps a sort of a philosophical level, it is very much about the collective good as opposed to the individual. Am I reading it correctly there?
Yeah, I probably should have started with that.
Mm-hmm. No, entirely fine. But I thought it was just really interesting how, you know, people always say, you know, the real sort of, you know, meta sort of focus of, you know, brand world for the last 50 years has essentially been all about the individual. Now a lot of that more collective sort of viewpoints coming in, which have, again, their good and also minus perspectives. What about the another one just to throw at you? So I'll have to do a couple to do them in whichever sort of order you like, but safer spaces and also social insulation.
So those, both of those are quite interesting in relation to the kind of squadiness that we just discussed.
Yeah.
The safer spaces, social insulation. I think if we, to kind of simplify, if we take it from the perspective of social platforms and a kind of hybrid digital IRL socialization, we lived through the era of what I think Venkatesh Rao calls the clear stream, which is, or the stadium style social media. So things like Twitter, of course, where you put something into the ether and you know kind of who your followers are, but it can very quickly expand beyond that set of followers. Of course, it came with the problems we are now all so deeply familiar with in terms of virality, but not also disinformation, but not only that, but the kind of detrimental effect it seemed to have on common discourse without kind of turning everything into something incredibly antagonistic or oversimplified. Mm. So this kind of idea of safer spaces or more closed communities is something we've seen, you know, it started perhaps in more like gaming centric areas of the internet, but is now incredibly mainstream. But if you look at Discord as a platform, for example, those are all open door, but kind of closed space communities, right? You kind of have to know about one to join it. And then once you join it, there's a bit of accountability and there's a bit of a sense of scale there. And these are kind of either seen as cozy web or dark forest areas to carry on with that mental model. And it's provided a sense of not only safety and insulation, but also a sense of continuity when it comes to things like developing ideas. Whether or not those are ultimately beneficial obviously depends on the kind of communities. In not saying that these are always like incredibly progressive, they can be fringe in a kind of worrying way as well. But for better or for worse, this is sort of where it's shaken out in terms of where a lot of the more radical thinking or a lot of the more progressive or impactful thinking on the internet, at least, is happening in these communities as opposed to within these stadiums, which are now kind of just seen as like broadcast centers.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And then when you also go on, I think, to a latter part of that report, in terms of, and I know these, I think this particular one was slightly going back in time. So at that point, it was an emerging trend, which is still absolutely fascinating, which you talked about, as I said, sort of next door communities with regards to disconnected neighbors.
I think that might have been in relation to the Nextdoor app in particular, which is a hilarious social media case study in that, you know, it's incredibly localized. So if you're not familiar with it, it's an app that's been kicking around for a while. You can download it. And in the pandemic, it was a lifeline. There was a lot of really positive elements to knowing who your neighbors were, how you could support them, kind of feeling a bit more comforted by, okay, all of a sudden you have a sense of who your surrounding community is. If you perhaps weren't someone who worked in your own neighborhood or spent a lot of time where you lived, it reconnected you to the individuals around you. But the kind of subculture or chatter around Nextdoor is also that it's become like a hub for kind of funny, passive-aggressive content, like rivalries, like a kind of like classic neighborly sniping and gossip as well. So it's really interesting as something that kind of reflects a real world. If you think about like an old Hollywood movie where everyone was kind of shouting up the floor, up a couple of floors of a building in Brooklyn or something, and you have that level of familiarity with your neighbors. Nextdoor kind of mimics that, but it's something that we wanted to track anyway, because it, you know, at a time of increased atomization, and especially among, I would say, kind of white collar or gentrifying neighborhoods where a lot of people did not feel entirely embedded in the place where they lived, like these apps became a way of almost piercing that and engendering a sense of immediate community that in a time of crisis suddenly became incredibly urgent. But of course, that is a very urban perspective. Nextdoor may be less essential or maybe more quotidian in a rural or suburban setting, for example, where you might know your neighbors a bit more.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned that point there about atomization. I think you always think back to the to that epic title, Bowling Alone, that was really always pointed to by the sort of trend researchers back in the day. But one of the other points you mentioned in the report, when you focus on South Korea, so it's really interesting that you mentioned there about, you know, older adults, particularly sort of, you know, the older boomers, perhaps finding a real sense of belonging via YouTube.
Yeah, I might need to check in with Liz about that case study in particular. But we have seen across the board in terms of community building, I think that a casual observer might think, okay, this kind of online stuff is very much for younger, very online demographics, right? But all over the place, but especially in South Korea and especially in Japan and the Philippines and markets where there's high levels of adoption with older people, this sense of kind of finding community and togetherness or even comfort online is not strictly reserved for young people at all. And there's a lot of, at this point, there's a lot of ease of use around, especially YouTube has been incredible at reaching very young and very old people in terms of its interface and navigability. I guess that's a positive story to come out of social media and belonging at this time.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, they're a completely different thing. What about sort of focusing perhaps more on brand world, or indeed a sort of, you know, organizational world, should we say? are there any ones that you tend to point to in your presentations when you, as examples of sort of best practice? As now, you know, here's an example, say, of a brand or organization that really gets it, that really understands the contemporary scene or where we're going, and actually is acting in a manner that is, you know, positive and useful and all the rest of it, and genuinely engaging, etc. Yeah, any of those that you sort of tend to have as your sort of a go-to favorites?
That is a great question. I think that a lot of brands that have previously nailed it are struggling a bit right now. So
how interesting.
I get the question a lot, but to be honest, I don't have a lot of examples of brands that I think are absolutely nailing this quite intensely chaotic moment. I think there were particular playbooks that were effective prior to the pandemic and prior to a kind of I would say massive social shift in terms of how we address things like anything within CSR and ethics. You know, there is I would call it now the millennial playbook of, you know, ethical communication, representation, inclusion, things like that, which are all still deeply important, but there is heightened cynicism around the impact of all of these things and much more people turning a much more cynical and often jaded eye towards these efforts. And in terms of world building itself, there is a huge question mark hovering around that, especially for brands that sit outside areas where traditionally brand worlds are regular practice. So brands outside of things like fashion or entertainment. You know, within fashion and entertainment, there's myriad examples. You can say Balenciaga has been really good at it, Marc Jacobs Heaven, even things like the Marvel Universe and the sort of persistence of that. You could point to as being kind of, the artist Ian Cheng defines a successful world as one that is kind of autonomous without its author. So when your audience begins to feel like they can participate in it, that they have their own theories about it, that they take your storylines, your IP and your material, and they create their own stuff with that.
Yep.
That's the only time you can think of it as being successful. And I would say outside of those two sectors, it becomes much more difficult to see that happening.
I think it's very interesting, again, back in the report you did last month, I think you had loads of examples of, or several examples of that fantastic element, as you put it, about sort of activity that show brands being autonomous without being authors of actually what's happening in the moment. And just the amount of sort of, you know, consumer or individual created content was great. Okay, then. So what about elsewhere then, at Alex? So, you know, obviously, we'll say you're obviously a massively inspirational individual, but go on then, where do you get your inspiration from?
That's a big question. I mean, I'm still an art girl at heart. I'm very still immersed in the art world, and my, you know, peers and heroes there are an endless fount of information. Artists like Annika Yee, Stephanie Komalang, Korakrit Arunanenshai are all figures who I really look up to in terms of, to be honest, the complexity of their world building, but also how deeply engaged in human realities their works are, and how much they pack in the complexity of the world that we live in into films and installations and even fragrances that are just also immediately emotionally present. So I'd say that's where a lot of the inspiration is drawn from. In terms of like things to watch in the future space, there's a DAO or decentralized autonomous organization called Radar.
Unpack that, be fantastic. I'm sure everyone would love to hear.
Yeah, so they're amazing. They're a decentralized approach to futures and trend watching. Perhaps we'll make us in the agency world seem a bit dinosaur-like in spite of feeling very current. But yeah. Not yet, but I think there's a potential to be a huge disruptor in the industry. And they pay special attention to things like signal scanning and trend interpretation, these kind of bread and butter of trend watching, trend forecasting, futures, and cultural consultancy. But they do it at this kind of truly collective scale. And in doing so, they tackle these like perennial industry problems like Western bias, curator centrism, conservatism around possible futures, and that kind of like DAO ethos, which we've seen in the kind of crypto space and beyond, actually works really well with things like trend forecasting, where you actually do need as wide and as unbiased a reach as possible to even begin to understand an accurate representation of where the future could go. So I'm very interested to see what they do next. But it's been incredibly active. I've been very impressed by their rigor so far.
Fantastic. And then what about books? Are you a great reader? And if so, anything you could recommend?
I am a huge nerd and am reading all the time, but a bit omnivorously. So sometimes I've been in a bit of a kind of like postmodern fiction phase. So I don't know whether that's that interesting or relevant right now. A good friend recommended a book by Megan O'Geeblin called God, Human, Animal, Machine. And I'm a bit already envious of it because it takes things I'm really interested in. So artificial intelligence, human knowledge, the purpose of life itself, but looks at it through that kind of art and technological and cultural sense. And from the sounds of it, it sounds like a really accomplished piece of work on how we imagine intelligence to begin with and why theological and philosophical questions are always attached to the artificial intelligence as a whole. So I'm really excited to get into that one, and probably prematurely I'm recommending it to the rest of you.
Fantastic. And then what about plans on the way? I know I'm certainly on the Canvas 8 side of things. I'm looking forward to, I think you've got a report coming up in regards to, as you put it, I think in inflationary times, what's the right roadmap for business? So it'd be great perhaps if you could talk a bit about that and also talk about yourself in terms of plans in the sort of a short to medium term future, other things that you're up to.
For sure. I believe my colleague, Tom Novak, who you guys might recognize other live sessions, will be leading on the inflation behaviors presentation. But that will be a classic kind of hard-hitting, very commercial perspective on how people's behavior is changing around things like more restrained consumption and the sort of tensions and expectations around that. So I'm looking forward to seeing what Tom comes up with there as well. In terms of more things going on at Canvas 8, we are refining and actually launching new futures products and methodologies. So keep an eye out on those in the future. Those are very much in hand with continuing work at the innovation program at St. Martin's. And I'm also working on a new book and finally collaborating with artists I really admire, Anna Engelhart and Mark Sinkovich, on their new film installation called Terror Element. So that will be debuting at the Transmedial Festival next year.
Nice. And in terms of, by the way, your book, when's that going to be out? Any ideas on sort of launch dates? Are we talking next year or year after or sooner?
I'm hoping the year after next year, but it's very much and it's still coming together, so it's in a cloud of ambiguity for now.
Before the sort of a mass panic at the end, one has to sort of speed up and get it finished. Yes.
Exactly. Being there.
Just as we begin to move towards the end of this podcast, it's been really, really enjoyable talking with you and to hear your viewpoints. Just also really interesting to hear your take on the tripartite ethos that goes through all of this series, and that is hope, community, and resilience. Just wondered what your viewpoints are on any or indeed all of those.
I love that ethos, especially as a tripartite one. My take on it is I feel like we've covered a lot of the importance of community in our conversation today, especially in a kind of, I think that, not to be too much of a doomer, but that is my colleague's joke, that's kind of my role. But in a world that's kind of emerged from like endangering conditions of that kind of polycrisis we are describing as even more hostile, volatile, and fragmented than before, things like community, hope, resilience, collective organization, imagining alternative futures, trying to kind of gather our collective desire into something productive as opposed to succumbing to that kind of nihilism and sense of dead end, nothing matters anymore kind of mindset will only become important. And I think that that's why initiatives like yours and many others, many people outside of this kind of, I'd say, mass surveys of mass pessimism are working to reinvigorate that sense of hope, of change, of really having to shift a paradigm that perhaps you felt a little too complacent within. It can all sound a bit utopian, but I really believe in that. And it seems like a lot of your guests do too. So I hope we can get there for sure. But those three pillars will only become more crucial as things perhaps get worse before they can get better.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for your sort of for your take on that. And then literally final thing, and that is, so everyone is totally clear about where they can track you down. Go on then, Alex, where are you on the relevant websites, et cetera?
Yeah, sure. You can find me on Instagram at AMFQ. And my website is amfq.xyz. And my Discord handle is on my website as well, if you prefer that. For Canvas 8 stuff in particular, definitely invite all you guys to sign up for the Long Read, which is a kind of in-depth cultural exploration that my colleagues put together monthly, which is, you know, always great reading. So you guys can find out more about us there.
Fantastic. So to Alex Kicho, the head of cultural intelligence at Canvas 8, the global behavioral insights practice operating out of London, LA, and New York, who help organizations grow through a better understanding of people. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. Just so you know, the trends and insights discussed in these podcasts link to my speeches. Check out seanpdc.com for more info, and to ongoing cultural and social research conducted by brandpositive.org.
Till next time, goodbye.